It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers and Republican legislative leaders announced yesterday they'd struck a deal to spend roughly $1.8 billion of the state's budget surplus. The legislation is headed for a vote before the full legislature as early as tomorrow. And if it passes, most of the money will go toward property tax relief, school funding, and refund checks for Wisconsin taxpayers. And later, we'll dig into the numbers with a policy analyst. But first, how did the governor and Republican lawmakers reach this bipartisan deal? For that, we turn to Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR State Capitol reporter. Hi, Anya.
Morning.
Wisconsin has been sitting on this $2.5 billion budget surplus, and there's been these ongoing discussions about what to do with that money. What kind of ideas were Republicans and Democrats bringing to the negotiating table and pretty dug in on?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a fight over this surplus for years and years and years, and it kind of has always had the same shape. So Democrats want to spend it on different priorities, K through 12 education, free school lunches, childcare subsidies. It's often just pointed to during normal debate as a way to pay for things that Democrats want. And Republicans have said over and over for years that they will only consider one thing, which is tax cuts. Their argument is that the surplus was created by taxpayer money. We need to give it back to taxpayers.
And the state has been running a surplus, bringing in more tax dollars than it spent since 2020. What do you think flipped the switch this time for lawmakers and the governor to come together and spend down this surplus money?
I mean, in some ways, it's a give and take of those two separate priorities at a time also that property taxes are just a very big deal for everyone, right? Everyone is feeling these very high property tax rates, which is both bad for lawmakers' constituents, and it's also bad electorally, right, in a midterm year. And so both sides want to be able to run on a win in that area. They certainly don't want to be running on sort of being branded as the cause of that crisis. And then at the same time, there's obviously a relationship between property taxes and school funding. A lot of communities have been going to referendum to raise their own property taxes in order to support their schools. And so Evers' argument all along has been that sort of because of that relationship, any tax relief has to include support for schools. And I think with, you know, the affordability crisis that's going on, that's given him some leverage. And that in turn gave Republicans some leverage for their tax priorities. And so there was a little bit more room for give and take than is typically the case.
With all of these financial pressures, this deal also comes 2 months after state lawmakers ended their regular session for the year. And then we have the upcoming retirement of Governor Evers, along with top Republicans in the two chambers. Did that move the needle?
Yeah, I do think that the fact that they're sort of all on their way out the door gives a little bit more flexibility to them personally. Like, they can kind of annoy their members and they don't necessarily have to worry about how that will blow back on them in future negotiations and future sessions. I also wonder, and I don't know this for sure, but if there's a question of sort of legacy, right? This has been a negotiation since at least January. And so to kind of end your final year in office, your tenure as a lawmaker with a failed negotiation would be, I think, a little bit of a whimper. And so I wonder if that's also part of the motivation.
Okay, so a big picture here. What are some of the banner items in this deal?
Yeah, so it's a roughly $1.8 billion deal. That's according to the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau. And broadly speaking, there's kind of two really big ticket items. So $870 million is going to go towards direct tax rebate payments. So everyone is going to get a $300 check in the next couple months. And then about $600 million is going to go towards education. That is split between general school aides and then boosting the special education reimbursement rate. That was a really big Evers priority. And then there's about $50 million in other types of property tax relief and $130 million to eliminate income tax on overtime pay and cash tips.
Okay, so with this deal, there are lawmakers who are not happy with the results. We heard from State Senator Kelda Royce yesterday, a Democrat from Madison who's also running for governor, called it the height of fiscal irresponsibility in a backroom deal. What are the objections coming out of the Capitol?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of opposition from Democrats using that phrase "backroom deal." Basically, they're saying that this is swapping permanent changes to the tax structure in exchange for one-time school aid, rather than just permanently funding schools at a level that Democrats would prefer. They also point out that this is a projected surplus and that costs are unclear right now, right, with rising inflation, rising gas prices, the war in Iran, and so that because the surplus isn't guaranteed, that this is irresponsible, as you just quoted her saying. Diane Hesselbein, who is the leading Democrat in the state Senate, was very pointed in saying that this is a deal from three men who will not be in elected office next year. She says, as far as she's concerned, there is no deal. So this idea, too, that it is a lame duck proposal that was hashed out behind closed doors.
Very quickly, Anya, could this deal get a vote tomorrow in the legislature?
I mean, the big thing that we are looking towards is what the Senate is going to do. But I will be heading to the Capitol in a couple of hours to see it taken up in committee. It's going before the Joint Finance Committee. And so it'll be really interesting to see both the sort of contours of debate there and also what the tone and tenor is before it heads forward to the floor.
Anya, thanks for the update. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR's state Capitol reporter as we are looking at this new budget deal reached by Governor Evers and Republicans in the state legislature. And we've been talking about the property tax relief on it, the more funding for schools. For a closer look now at the numbers, we turn to Tyler Burns, senior research associate at Wisconsin Policy Forum. Tyler, thanks for being here.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
Well, let's break down this property tax relief. How does this deal ease up the tax burden for property owners around the state?
So it does so by providing $300 million in general school aids that the state then passes along to school districts. And the way that results in property tax relief is there's a limit in state law that says each school district can raise a certain amount of money per student through a combination of property taxes and this type of general school aid. And so if you don't change that limit and you increase the amount of state money that goes into that calculation, you end up with a reduction in the property taxes. And so, this $300 million, even though it's passed through general school aids, doesn't actually result in any additional spendable money by schools, but it does result in a decrease in how much local property taxpayers are contributing to school districts.
Okay, so we've seen referendums all over the state by the dozens. Does this deal make an impact there? Will schools still have to keep going to referendum on local ballots for a while?
So the $300 million of general school aids likely won't help as much with that. What will help is the $300 million in special education aids. Mm-hmm. Special education costs have been rising. The state's reimbursement for special education costs has been shrinking. And so the money for special education has to come out of school district budgets. And by reducing the pressure of those costs of providing special education, potentially you could see a reduction in the number of referendums. But again, it's $300 million. It's a pretty substantial increase. It's about a 5%, it's about a 25% increase over what the state has already been spending on special education. Mm-hmm. But without allowing school districts to raise their revenue from property taxes and other state aids, the impact will likely be mixed, and we're likely to see referendums continue in the future.
Okay, we'll keep our eye on that as we see those numbers shake out. But let's take a look at these refund checks. $300 for individuals who filed a tax return in 2024, $600 for married couples. Will this have a meaningful impact on Wisconsin families? What could the impact be?
I think it will depend on, who ends up getting these. It's per taxpayer, but there's also some phase outs. If you don't have very much tax liability, you get sort of the lesser amount. Thinking about like a family budget, $600 is meaningful. That's a couple of car payments. That's a pretty substantial amount as costs have been going up. But it's unlikely to sort of change the trajectory of family budgets, let's say. But it's You know, it's a meaningful amount, $600.
So this deal will also eliminate tax on cash tips and overtime pay. What kind of workers will see the biggest impact from this policy?
So that's likely, you know, service workers and folks that, you know, work in, you know, construction that do a lot of overtime, manufacturing. And so, you know, again, that will tend to fall mostly to folks in sort of the lower to middle income range. One thing that's important to remember anytime that there's a tax deduction or tax exemption created and it's not refundable, if you don't have any income tax liability, reducing the amount of income taxes you're supposed to pay doesn't really help because you're already at zero. And so, you know, lower income folks tend to not have as much income tax liability. So if it's, so this sort of thing at the bottom end of the income scale might not make as big a difference. But, you know, people who are out there working, have jobs, getting tips, you know, this would be a benefit to them.
Tyler, you've done research at the Policy Forum about our state's record low tax burden in 2023. And that year, Wisconsinites paid a smaller portion of their personal income in state and local taxes than ever before. Has that trend continued?
That trend has actually continued. We, in 23, we set a record low. And then in 24, we set another record low. 25, we tied that record low. And so, you know, what's happening there is taxes are being cut, but then also people's incomes are growing faster than what taxes are growing at. And so we've gone from being a high tax state, we were in the top five, to now we're down around 35 in the country. And so that's sort of changed the dynamics here in the state.
Very quickly, what will you be watching for in this $1.8 billion spending deal as it carries on here?
So what I'm looking at is the ongoing spending of about $750 million. Looking forward to the next budget, we were already in a position where at the end of 2027, we were going to spend more than we brought in by about $1 billion. This adds to that. And so the 27-29 budget going forward might be a little tougher, especially if, you know, as you alluded to in the earlier segment, some of these economic uncertainties sort of drive revenue collections downward.
Tyler, thank you so much. Thanks for the analysis. Appreciate it.
Thank you again for having me on. Have a good day.
You too. Tyler Burns, Senior Research Associate at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Earlier, we heard from WPR's state capital reporter, Anya Van Wagtendonk. And we've been talking about a new state budget deal reached by Governor Evers and the Republican legislative leaders to spend down the surplus. The agreement was announced yesterday and is set to go to a vote as early as tomorrow. Coming up, it's property tax assessment season, and for the first time, Madison assessors recently valued single-family homes over $500,000 on average. Hear from the city about some of the forces driving up values.
Our assessments are catching up to where the market was bringing us in those pre-COVID years, and things have slowed down.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is property tax assessment season in much of the state. Depending on where you are, homeowners receive new assessments at least once every 5 years or as often as once a year. And last week, the city of Madison sent out its new property value assessments to local residents, with single-family homes exceeding $500,000 on average for the first time. And Milwaukee's assessments also came out recently. This all comes ahead of the traditional home buying season as property values and estimated sale prices continue to rise. Rob Ferret spoke last week with two assessors from the city of Madison about how the process works and the impact it has. Megan Lukens is assessment business systems manager and Scott West is assessment operations manager for Madison. They spoke with Rob Ferret.
Let's start with the outcome of the assessment. I see the city's average value for single-family homes grew by about nearly 4% last year. That's fairly low, I understand, in the post-COVID times. Scott, let's start with you. What does that tell you about what's happening in Madison housing?
It indicates the market has probably cooled off a little bit for us in Madison, although we're usually pretty robust from year to year. I don't think we've had quite the volume of sales. Megan can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I don't think we had the volume of sales as we've had other years.
And Megan, how does our property value change now compared to, say, the pre-COVID era when a place like Madison, it could be a pretty hot time for property values going up?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is that our assessments are catching up to where the market was bringing us in those pre-COVID years, and things have slowed down. Scott's correct. The number of sales have decreased year over year. So we're seeing a situation where we don't have the supply. And so that lesser volume of sales is also kind of helping the market cool down a little bit.
All right, I want to get into a little assessment 101, because homeowners wherever you are in the state get that assessment and might wonder, well, where'd that number come from? Scott, what goes into that assessment? What leads to that number we get in the mail?
Well, every year we do an interim market update, which means we review all the market information that we receive from the prior year. For instance, this is a January 1, 2026 assessment that people have just received in the mail. And that's based on a market that occurred in 2025. We review all the sales that occurred during that time period. We verify them through various resources to ensure that they represent arm's length market transactions. And then we use those sales to determine what the market is doing in different parts of the city. We have the city broken up into individual neighborhoods, so we'll review what we call a market trend is in each neighborhood, and then we apply that neighborhood basis. So some neighborhoods may have went, you know, it's a range of percentages out there that based on what we see in recent sales that have occurred.
And Megan, do things like improvements to a house affect that assessment? If I build that new, water slide in my backyard, does that go into the assessment?
Yes, we have to look at what's called permitted work. So we get information from the building inspection department about permits that are pulled, and those values are adjusted based on the percent completion of that project.
And Megan, staying with you for a moment, now state law requires assessments at least every 5 years. Some communities do that exactly once every 5 years. Some places like Madison do it every year. Why those more regular assessments?
Yeah, in the city of Madison, it's really for two primary reasons. One, doing assessments year over year and staying current with the market allows property owners to experience slow and steady growth over time. It also allows us to kind of help control things if we have extreme assessment years. So like post-COVID, when we were seeing properties sell for 40%, 60% over their assessments, to curtail having a bubble market, we were able to take those percent changes and aggregate them out over a number of years, so that property owners don't experience extreme highs or extreme lows in their assessment. And the second reason is just volume. We have 90,000 parcels that we're reviewing on an annual basis. If we let those 90,000 parcels sit for, say, 5 years, and then in one singular year, we had to catch up all of those properties to current market over 5 years, we wouldn't be able to accomplish that volume of work in that time frame.
Now, Scott, I understand there's about $1 billion in new construction in the city of Madison. How much of the increase in assessment is, hey, there's a lot of new buildings, there's a lot of new construction, and that's raising values versus, hey, these houses are sitting there, people are more interested in them over time, demand is high, and that's what's driving the increase in assessments over time?
Well, it's kind of both, right? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of new construction in the city of Madison, and there's also a lot of interest in existing homes. So it's kind of a combination. But I mean, the increase in market value is more of what has occurred on the sales level, what has people bought and sold. And that's what drives our trends in the neighborhoods. The new construction that occurs are on more of a, that's for growth for the city of Madison, first of all. And then it's also on a per parcel basis. So, you know, If someone builds a 300-unit apartment building, we're applying that new construction value to that parcel over, you know, individually Just like if you add an addition to your house, we would look at what we would price that out and then add that to that property, and then look at how that affects what the market value of that is by comparing it to other homes. So.
And Megan, one of the uses of the assessment is to determine how much homeowners pay in property taxes, right? Can you connect the dots? What does that assessment translate into when it comes to that annual property tax bill?
Yeah, that is obviously the, you know, primary concern that the majority of folks have when they're engaging with our office. And while the assessor's office doesn't have any say in what happens with the taxes, our values are the foundation for which all city services are then able to be funded off of. So what happens is the idea is a revenue neutral change overall, meaning that if everyone goes up about the same amount, the same percentage, we have those average changes, you should see little to no change in your taxes. It's revenue neutral. The taxes are determined based on the needs of the different taxing jurisdictions. And so we have schools included in that, the state, the county, and then local, and the technical colleges. Those are all funded through property taxes. So there's a lot of folks who are engaging in services and needs and funding their specific areas out of that tax base.
If, say, I and my neighbors both go up 4%, our taxes probably won't change relative to each other. If theirs goes up 2% and mine goes up 10%, maybe because of my water slide, that will mean I'll probably pay more taxes relative to my neighbor. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. We're looking to have everyone pay their fair share, right? Assessments should be equitable relative to one another. And that's part of also analyzing the market every year helps maintain equity in the city as well.
And Scott, after these numbers come out, every community will have some kind of objection procedure or a challenge procedure. What goes into that? What kind of things can people bring to the city's attention and say, hey, I think this is too high or too low, I guess, if they wanted to?
They can bring sales that they feel are comparable to them, as far as different attributes of a property that sold recently in their neighborhood or nearby that they think is comparable to them that they believe shows that they should have a lower assessment. They could condition of the property could also be a good indicator that they could provide us with photos or video, or we could they can also request an inspection that we can come out and take a look at it if needed. Locational issues could be another reason. Maybe they back up to a refinery or something, just as an example, that they feel, affects the market value of their property. And we'll consider, any type of evidence. And then we do our own analysis to see if the evidence they've provided does influence the value or not.
And Megan, as we wrap up, is there something that people either tend to get wrong about the assessment process or be really confused about?
I think it's just that contacting the assessor's office because you feel that you're paying too much in property taxes. Unfortunately, there's nothing that we in the assessor's office can do about that. That requires a change at the legislative level, and there isn't anything we can do. What we do inquire folks to do, though, is we encourage them, I should say, to contact our office. We have lots of information. Our website is a really great resource. Those comparable sales that Scott was talking about, we have a page on our website where folks can dive into their specific assessment areas and find those recent sales so that they can get educated about what's happening in the market and better understand. And to contact our office, and we're happy to answer questions and get folks information if they're interested in filing an appeal.
We'll leave it there. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Scott, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Megan Lukens and Scott West with the City of Madison Assessor's Office. We've been talking about property assessments with new numbers out for cities like Madison and Milwaukee, still having time to file objections. Now, the booming housing market in recent years has been pushing up real estate prices, with the average value for Madison, for example, homes now exceeding $500,000. Here to talk about the state of the real estate market as we head into the buying season is Robert Proctor, real estate attorney and government affairs director for the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we've got this assessed property value for a house, and then we've got what a house actually sells for. How much do those two things connect to each other, or are they kind of different animals?
They can be different animals. This year, I did review the city's assessments for the city of Madison, and they're up approximately 4.8 for a residential property. And the year-to-date median price in Dane County is up about 4.6%. So as a total, they are pretty close to each other. However, when you look at individual properties, there's often differences that appear regarding the value of that property or the sales price compared to the assessment. The city assessor will review 90,000 properties in a year. So their methodology is much more broad-based. And then they have some other issues that they have to address, like equalization of values and so forth, where if you were going to, for example, have your property appraised, you have an appraiser looking specifically at your property and looking at comps specifically as they relate to your property, and they spend more time on that one property. And so sometimes there can be a disconnect between what the assessed value is for specific properties and what maybe the true market value is, which is the point of why there's an open book and an appeal process.
Now, Madison's average value for single family homes exceeded $500,000 for the first time in this assessment. Prices have been going up for some time now. What is driving that? Seems like a lot for an average price or average value for single family homes.
It is. But it's really just a supply shortage. Right now, the market seems to be in neutral, and it's in neutral because of the lack of supply. We just have more buyers than we have sellers, certainly in Dane County, but even for the entire state. The biggest reason for that goes way back to when the housing market bubble burst back in 2008. Prior to 2008, for example, in Dane County, there were two times as many permits being pulled by builders to build houses than we are building today. And there's a lot of reasons that go into it, but the truth of it is that new home construction is about half of what it was prior to the 2008 recession. And Madison and Dane County are growing faster than any county in the state. And when those two things happen, you have a lot more demand than you have supply, and the costs go up.
Robert, a story I'm hearing in other communities in the state is that you have people, seniors, right, who might be ready to sell their house and downsize or something like that, but they don't see that house out there to downsize to, so they stay in their house now. Is that something you're seeing in South Central Wisconsin as well, that, hey, people are hanging on to that house where we might have expected it to go on the market?
Absolutely. Most seniors and empty nesters, they want to age in place. That may not be the house, but they're comfortable with the city and the neighborhood that they live in. And for a long period of time in Dane County, Madison, we just weren't building what we call the missing middle. The type of houses or apartments that downsizing seniors or empty nesters would be willing to move into. Accordingly, they hold on to their house. And then all of that inventory isn't available for the next generation. And that's been a huge issue. And there's been a lot of efforts to start creating more senior housing, to create more senior housing, to create more missing middle, to create more options for empty nesters and seniors to move into. But it's a slow process. It's sort of like steering a ship. We do incremental changes now, and over time, we'll see the benefit of them. But there's no magic wand that will just allow that inventory to appear.
Robert, another story I'm hearing in communities around the state is a lack of starter homes, right? That younger first-time home buyer. What are you seeing in South Central Wisconsin?
We are seeing an absolute crisis when it comes to starter homes for the next generation. The average age, the average median age for a first-time home buyer in Wisconsin is now 40 years old, which is the obvious. That means that this generation is now staying in apartments and renting until age 39. That's a huge issue. It affects everything from starting families, raising kids, building wealth for that generation. And it's a number that is really troubling. And hopefully, with a lot of the changes that you're seeing at the state level and at the local level, we're going to see more production of single family homes to hopefully start bringing the cost in line with people's income and to bring that number down so people can afford a home for their family much earlier in life.
Now, we heard from the Madison assessors there. You're working in South Central Wisconsin. Are rising prices in Madison driving housing costs in the surrounding communities, counties, maybe even in a widening radius?
I believe so, yes. The fact is that the Madison is growing very fast. The cost of land and the cost of construction in Madison is high. So many families, many young families, and many people are looking for more affordable housing. They look further away from the city of Madison, and now they become competitors in that market. And the more people you have competing for homes, the more you see prices rise. So the growth of Madison certainly has a impact on the surrounding neighborhoods, surrounding communities, and certainly even the surrounding counties.
Robert, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Proctor is a real estate attorney and government affairs director for the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. We previously heard from Megan Lukens, assessment business systems manager for the city of Madison, and Scott West, assessment operations manager for the city of Madison. They spoke with host Rob Ferret about property values, tax assessments, and what's all playing into the state of the real estate market going into the buying season. Girls high school flag football is growing in popularity across Wisconsin. Dozens of schools have programs. Hear from coaches and a player from Oneida Nation High School on why the sport is so appealing.
There's a little bit of contact, and I like a little bit of contact sports. It's fun. I like to run. I just like the physicality in it.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Girls high school flag football is growing in popularity across Wisconsin. At least 33 schools in the state have active girls flag football programs, and a few dozen others have expressed interest in launching a team. Last week, the Green Bay Packers awarded $5,000 in grants to 20 schools to help their flag football programs. They gave the same round of funding to 20 other schools last spring. Schools are hoping to see the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association officially recognize the sport in the future. We're checking in with girls' flag football teams from two different regions of the state participating this spring and summer. Giovanna Espinoza is a sophomore on the Oneida Nation High School girls' flag football team, and Anthony Cornelius is her head coach. And Dale Carlson is the head coach of the combined Port Washington-Grafton girls' flag football team. They spoke with Rob Ferret last week.
Anthony, can you start us off with a quick rundown of the rules of girls' high school flag football? For that person who's been watching football, what would they see that's a little different?
I think it's pretty similar to the regular game of football. Obviously, it's a lot more condensed, and there's a lot of different versions of it as well. We play 5v5, but there's also like 6v6, 7v7, 8v8. So like not seeing the linemen out there blocking, like just little things like that. Otherwise, I think from watching regular football to girls high school flag football, you'll see a lot more like trick plays or, you know, like double reverses that you're not going to see every single play on the normal game, I guess.
And Giovanna, as a player, what do you like about playing flag football? What made you want to give it a try?
I don't know. It was just something new. And then once I really tried it, it was like, I don't know, I got into a groove and it was like, there's a little bit of contact and I like a little bit of contact sports. It's fun. I like to run. I just like the physicality in it.
And Dale, you not only are working with Port Washington Grafton High School as the team, you also organized a summer league as a coach and a league organizer. What is it that's driving you to put this on the map?
That's a great question. I never really have an answer for that. People ask me, but, you know, I've told the girls and I tell myself this is, you know, you got to keep trying new things. You got to keep experiencing new things. And those are the treasures in life. And so I just saw an opportunity that some of the other states starting this. And I thought, why not us? And I do have a daughter who's 12, so hopefully, or 13. Hopefully in the near future, she'll be a part of the program. But if she's not, it's fine. I still created something that I think is worthwhile and will stay in the community for a long time.
Anthony, there's been a wider effort to promote this, and I'll say, I should disclosure, my daughter played on a flag football team her last year of college. She got they got there just in time for her. It's just, you know, the Packers, the NFL, some colleges are getting into it. Are you seeing a lot more interest in girls flag football?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Just us being invited to the Packers Open that they had probably, I think it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. Yeah, we're in our third year now. So just being invited into that. And then even from then, just seeing like the growth of the amount of teams. And I think it's especially here in Wisconsin, it's the Packers that are really pushing this. And the community outreach program is just really trying to invite as many teams as possible just to come try it out. And I think like once you actually put a team in and you just try it out, like it's just going to gain so much traction from there. And then obviously, you know, the Olympics, having it as a sport in there, I think like all of the drive behind it, it's good. You're going to continue to see it grow within Wisconsin, but then around the country as well.
And Giovanna, I want to hear about your athletic interests. Is this the first team sport for you, or have you been an athlete for a while and this is a new part of your portfolio? Like,
yeah, I've been an athlete for a while. I do multiple different sports. Flag football is just something that I wanted to try, and then I just ended up loving to do it.
And now, when I've seen a girls flag football, Giovanna, people are playing both sides, right? They're playing offense and defense. Is that happening at your team with the Oneida Nation High School?
Yeah, people play offense and defense. It really depends, like, what your strengths are and what you're really, like, better at doing and feel comfortable with.
Now, Dale, take us into forming that league now. What was it like getting not just your own team up to speed, but working with other schools and getting their programs and figuring out your schedule and all that?
Yeah, I had originally started just thinking that maybe it would be an intramural type program where just the girls between Port and Grafton, we would mix up and maybe play against each other, playing 5v5. But once we formed, once the word got out, once the word spread with help of the Packers database, teams started to reach out and say, hey, we're thinking about having a team, or we're forming a team this fall. Can we play? And what started as an intramural focused program quickly turned into playing against other teams. And we played against it ourselves, but we played far more against other teams now that some of the schools in the Milwaukee area and even up in Appleton, once they've created their school programs, it's really quite easy to find another school that's willing and able. It's really just finding the season that works for people. There's obviously other sports that conflict at times, and we kind of picked summer for our league because there's really no better time to play football in Wisconsin than the summer. You got great weather, you have field time. You still have some conflicts and stuff, but that's kind of how it started, and that's where it's turned into.
And Anthony, how about you? Are you finding teams to play against, and where did you end up falling for what time of year you play?
Yeah, we're kind of like in the mix. It's kind of hard, especially at a smaller school, to kind of navigate multi-sport athletes within the same season. Here at Oneida, we're really, really flexible. We try to allow kids to do, you know, we have kids that play, especially like on the boys' side, we have kids that play lacrosse, track, and then they do golf as well. You know, so on the girls' side, they do track and flag football, and we try to manage both to allow them to try to make both happen. So I can see like the struggle of the dynamic of the season, especially adding a new sport. And then in a small school, like you're pulling from all the same athletes, you know? So for us, we do the spring season, but we're really flexible to just trying to make whatever work to kind of continue to grow the sport. Like you don't want to see it die out just because you can't get enough kids to field a team. So, you know, with track season and flag football, you're pulling all of your top athletes together all in one. And it's just being able to do that. So for us, like, the last couple of years, we've kind of just been doing the Packers tournaments, but this year we're in the NFL Flag Huskies League in Suamico, and we've been playing against Southwest and Little Chute. But I do know there's other leagues around the area. Appleton has one, and then Green Bay East just started a league, I believe. So we're just trying to keep our options open to kind of get the most opportunities out of this.
And Giovanna, your coach mentioned, you know, making sure you can field a team. Are you helping recruit? Do you encourage other girls at your school to give it a try?
Yeah, sometimes. Like, I don't know. I don't really want to be too pushy when it comes to sports, but it's just like, if they have an interest, then yeah, I like encourage them to come try it out at least, because it doesn't hurt like to try and try something new.
We're talking about the growth of girls' high school flag football here in Wisconsin. With us, we have sophomore Giovanna Espinoza and head coach Anthony Cornelius from the United Nation High Schools team and head coach Dale Carlson from the combined Port Washington Grafton girls' flag football team. Dale, we've mentioned the Packers a couple times. They've been providing funding. They just announced their latest round of funding for high schools. Both of your teams that we're talking about here got that funding, I believe, last year. What did that funding from the NFL team here in the state mean for your local program there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really the volunteers that are kind of the engine of getting this started. You know, some of the local parents, coaches, players. We've been the engine, but Packers have been the fuel that have really kept it going and really has moved this forward. I think a lot of these schools would have had a hard time starting their league if it wasn't for the Packers with that influx of money and equipment, right? There's a bunch of equipment that they send over as well to get you going. And it's not an expensive sport to play year in and year out, but it does take a little bit in the upstart at the beginning to get it going. So the Packers support has been crucial, not just for myself, but I think for all these teams to really get going.
Yeah, Anthony, same question. What is the Packers support last year meant for your program there?
Yeah, it's helped us out. Like you said, the amount of equipment that they send you a bunch of flags, they send you a bunch of footballs, cones, just little things, stopwatches, whistles, you know, little things that you don't think about that might add up, you know, in the end, when especially when you're thinking about startup costs. We have a pretty supportive community here, so a lot of different fundraising efforts and things like that to be able to do kind of whatever we want to do. Our business committee, our first year, sponsored us like $3,500. So that allowed us to buy jerseys for the girls. We got to get them all geared up in gloves and kind of get them just the look of a flag football player when we first went out there. And, you know, it's like a look good, feel good, play good type thing. So, yeah, we're definitely appreciative for all the efforts and opportunities that we get from the Packers, especially financially.
Now, Giovanna, I'm curious, we're seeing some colleges pick this up. UW-Stout had a good year in the pilot program, for example. Do you see this as something that you might, even after high school, want to play, either recreationally or at a college?
Yeah, I went to this flag football showcase where there were a bunch of colleges and they were scouting. And it really interested me to see that because maybe, like, I don't know, for the future, like, yeah, I would think about doing flag football in college or even, like, just a bunch of other sports in college. So that was really great to see and great to experience.
Now, Dale, this is not a sport yet that has the WIAA, the official, you know, state sanctioning board for high school sports. It's not there yet. But are you hoping that as these programs continue, this could be on that roster of official high school sports in the state?
Yeah, definitely hopeful. I think it should be. Again, I think there's definitely some things to work out, right? Field time and time of year, the seasons. So we've got an uphill battle, but the interest is there. I mean, the number of girls that have joined the teams and the leagues, it's growing every year. I don't see it stopping. So definitely should be considered.
And Anthony, there's a lot of attention to flag football in general because of the 2028 Olympics now. There's going to be men's and women's flag football. Let's look ahead a little bit. Do you see that maybe being a shot in the arm for the sport and getting more people to give it a try?
Oh, yeah. I think that's what's really driving this whole thing is the Olympics adding it. And then you kind of just see everything just follow suit after that. Colleges are starting to add flag football into their programs and stuff like that. So, you know, you're only going to see it trickle down. And I really hope here in Wisconsin that it really starts to grow. And like you said earlier, hopefully become a WIA sanctioned sport soon.
Giovanna, for the student body at Oneida Nation High School in general, do you feel supported by your fellow students? Are people coming to watch you play?
Yeah, of course. I feel super supported, especially at Oneida. The level of support here is unlike anything that you'll ever see. People will come out and support, and like, I'll just see people and they'll just be like, hey, you did amazing. Like, even some people that I don't even know. And that level of support really is amazing to see. And yeah, it's just a great and strong community to be in when playing flag football.
Dale, if there's somebody listening at a high school right now that doesn't have this program and is thinking, yeah, this sounds like a good match for my school, what do you suggest on how to get rolling?
Well, there is some support and help from the Packers. Of course, they can always reach out to me. The league and the team has a Facebook page. Locally, there's lots of schools that have already reached out, and I've kind of supported or guided them on how I started mine, and I guided them on how to start theirs. So the whole process is pretty easy. Really, it's just getting the word out there that you're starting a program. But yeah, the support is definitely out there, whether it's through the Packers or just through the other schools. We're more than happy to help anybody get a program started.
That's interesting. Anthony, are you getting calls or emails from people at other schools asking how you got it rolling?
Oh, yeah. I feel like it's like every week, you know, there's teams that are asking which leagues people are playing in. And there's like a lot of colleges are actually reaching out like every single week of just, hey, let your kids know we're hosting this flag football camp this summer. We would like to get kind of rolling, especially in the early ages of the 2027s, the 2028s, the 2029 classes, and just really trying to get them recruited and get them on, you know, on their radar really early, especially like Giovanna said, when we went to that college flag football showcase, they're talking about, you know, these Wisconsin colleges, they're recruiting from girls from California, Las Vegas, you know, so they're not just looking inside the state, but they're looking, you know, nationally. So you never know who's out there, especially on the national level, maybe looking at Wisconsin athletes as well.
And Giovanna, I know you said you don't want to be pushy about the sports you play, but what would you say to maybe that middle school girl who's coming into high school? What would you say to encourage them to at least check out flag football?
Don't be afraid to keep your options open. If you want to try something new, just always keep that option open in your mind. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there, try something new. Even if it's like a little physical, maybe out of your comfort zone, just trying something new won't hurt.
Oh, and I got to ask, Giovanna, is it fun?
Of course it's fun. It's so fun. Like just being able to play around with your friends and all that laughter, but even like that competitiveness, it's so fun.
We'll leave it there. Thanks, Giovanna, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Anthony, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Dale, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Giovanna Espinoza is a sophomore on the Oneida Nation High School girls flag football team. Anthony Cornelius is the team's head coach. Dale Carlson is head coach of the combined Port Washington Grafton girls flag football team. And they all spoke with Rob Ferret last week. Congratulations are in order for a group of sixth graders from Rice Lake. The robotics team at St. Joseph Catholic School earned the prestigious VEX IQ Elementary Excellence Award at the Robotics World Championship held recently in St. Louis, Missouri. And according to the Rice Lake area newspaper, The Chronotype, this accomplishment is historic not only for Rice Lake, but for the entire state of Wisconsin. No Wisconsin VEX robotics team at any level has ever won an Excellence Award. And this year, thousands of VexIQ teams from more than 60 countries competed in the season. Way to go, Spartan Robotics Club. Keep on programming. Wisconsin Today producers include Rochelle Wilson, Royce Padeswa, and Lauren Cox. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.